In this weekend's episode, three segments from this past week's Washington Journal. First, National Constitution Center's Jeffrey Rosen discusses the importance of Constitution Day. Then, presidential historian Richard Norton Smith discusses the two assassination attempts against former President Gerald Ford. Plus, Brookings Institution's William Galston on why the national debt is not being discussed this presidential cycle. But first, for this week's show on Constitution Day, National Constitution Center's Jeffrey Rosen joins the program to discuss the importance of the document in American life today.
Ryan Reynolds here for, I guess, my 100th Mint commercial. No. I mean, honestly, when I started this, I thought I only have to do like four of these. I mean, it's unlimited premium wireless for $15 a month. How are there still people paying two or three times that much? I'm sorry, I shouldn't be victim blaming here. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/save, whenever you're ready.
$45 upfront payment equivalent to $15 per month. New customers on first 3 month plan only. Taxes and fees extra. Speeds slower above 40 gigabytes. See details.
This episode is brought to you by Ring Cameras and Doorbells. A lot happens while you're away from home. That's why Ring makes it easy to check in from anywhere. Whether you're saying hi to an unexpected guest, making sure those packages are safe, or keeping your pets company while you're out grabbing groceries. It's all a few taps away, right from your phone. Be there with Ring. Explore cameras, doorbells, alarm kits, and more right now at ring.com.
On this National Constitution Day, we're joined once again by Jeffrey Rosen, President and CEO of the National Constitution Center. And Mr. Rosen, I want to start with something that Mitch McConnell said on the Senate floor yesterday at the start of the day. He said, quote, "This second attempted assassination of Donald Trump should provide a moment of soul searching for all Americans and reflection about the ways our political process has been injected by reprehensible violence." Is there any lesson that we can take from the U.S. Constitution in this moment as we reflect on what happened 2 days ago, what's happened this election cycle?
Well, it's absolutely true that the whole point of the Constitution was to test the proposition, as John Jay said in the first Federalist paper, can a republic be guided by reason and conviction, not by force or violence? And the founders recognized that republics are fragile, that in history many of them fell to violence or demagoguery, and it's urgently important to maintain the Constitution and the rule of law. That's the one thing that stands between us and violence. It's what's made us the greatest republic in the world for nearly 250 years. And all Americans, regardless of their political background, must embrace the principles of the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution.
So we showed viewers a Gallup poll in our last segment showing that a record low percentage of Americans are not satisfied with the way democracy is working in this country. Back in the 80s and 90s, doubled the amount of Americans, more than 60% were satisfied with the way democracy worked. Is it a failure of the system? Is it a failure of the Constitution that we're at the point that just 28% of Americans say they're satisfied with how this all works?
The question of trust in government has divided people ever since Hamilton and Jefferson debated it at the founding. Hamilton thought citizens had a responsibility to confide confidence in government in between elections and give it the power to achieve a strong military and a strong economy. Jefferson thought that citizens should question government and always use liberty to challenge power. So the fact that people are not sure about whether to entrust confidence in government is not new. We are more polarized than at any time since the Civil War, according to scholars. And we know that in the Civil War, the Union broke, the war came. So it's important to take seriously the lack of satisfaction of citizens. But it's not that, but it's the Constitution that holds us together, not that brings us apart. It provides a platform for the constructive exchange of views. The Constitution is made for people of fundamentally differing points of view, as Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes said, and therefore it's especially at times of declining trust in government that it's important to rally around the Constitution.
I don't have the data on this, but do you think that lack of trust, lack of confidence in the government, this polling question, is it correlated, do you think, with people's understanding of the United States Constitution? Did we have a better understanding, appreciation of the Constitution back in the 80s and 90s when those numbers were higher? Do we have less of an understanding of the Constitution today? Which, asking this question on Constitution Day?
That's a really good question. And first of all, happy Constitution Day. It's so exciting.
Same to you, sir.
You on September 17th, we're so looking forward to an amazing day of celebrations at the National Constitution Center. And it's great to start the day with you. You know, this is a time of declining trust in all institutions, and there are lots of reasons for that, including social media and polarization. But it's a really interesting question about whether there was more confidence during the founding because of civic education. And there's no question that almost all the founders, starting with George Washington, thought that it was urgently important for citizens to learn about the Constitution, in particular the principles of liberty that it embodied, and also the habits of deliberation that it made possible in order to keep the Republic. And they thought without that civic education, the Republic would fall. So, and this is, as you started with the Annenberg poll, a time of declining knowledge in the Constitution, and therefore there may be some connection between the lack of civic education and the lack of confidence in our institutions.
I know you were listening in a bit to that conversation we had in our first half hour this morning about how people would change the Constitution if they could, if they could propose an amendment. I wonder what stuck out to you from that conversation.
Well, first, that it was such an informed and vigorous and thoughtful conversation. There's nothing like C-SPAN viewers to present diverse perspectives about constitutional issues. It's inspiring to hear how engaged people are. One thing that jumped out was the gentleman from New Jersey who proposed three changes to the Constitution, ending the debt ceiling, stalemate, and also amending the Electoral College were among his suggestions.
And his third was getting money out of politics.
That's right, and which would require overturning the Citizens United decision. Interestingly, those proposals were included among those offered by a series of liberal, conservative, and progressive teams that the National Constitution Center convened to propose constitutional amendments. And I think the progressives proposed a Citizens United amendment, and both the conservatives and the progressives were open to amending the Electoral College, interestingly. So we convened all three teams for a virtual constitutional convention, and what emerged blew my mind. It was so surprising and so inspiring. The teams agreed on five amendments to the Constitution. Who would have expected that these people who so strongly disagree, conservatives, progressives, and also libertarians, leading scholars in all camps, agreed on five amendments.
That was National Constitution Center's Jeffrey Rosen. Next, historian and Gerald Ford biographer Richard Norton Smith discussed the two attempts on President Gerald Ford's life that took place in September 1975.
Joining us on the phone to discuss the history here is Richard Norton Smith, presidential historian. He's author of Ordinary Man, The Surprising Life and Historic Presidency of Gerald Ford. Mr. Smith, good morning to you. Take us back to September 1975. What happened that month in San Francisco and Sacramento?
Well, the 5th of September, the president was in Sacramento. He was there to speak to the state legislature. And also, people forget, Ronald Reagan, the very popular former governor of California, was about to formally announced his challenge. So the president was in California twice in September for political reasons. He never thought that he could take California away from Reagan, but they wanted him to have to work on his home turf. So he was in Sacramento. He walks out of the hotel, which is right across the street from the state capitol, says, "It's a beautiful day. I think I'll walk." Well, it's only a short distance, and there were several hundred people who were assembled on the grounds, hoping to get a glimpse of him in the limousine. Well, you can imagine how delighted they were to meet him in person. So anyway, it's interesting. I remember having a conversation with the president. He said, you know, remember, I was on the Warren Commission. He'd been one of those seven commissioners who were charged with investigating the murder of President Kennedy. He said, I'm aware. I was sort of keep an eye out as I look at the crowd. And he saw out of the corner of his eye this woman. He said he remembered she had a weathered face and a kind of odd reddish-orange dress on. And he thought she wanted to talk to him. And they met in the magnolia tree just outside the Capitol. And the next thing he knew, she had reached down, pulled up 45 Colt semi-automatic pistol out of an ankle holster, And she said, the country's in a mess. This man's not your president. Well, at that moment, Larry Boondorf, who was the head Secret Service agent, there were about a dozen agents that day protecting the president, he said the one word that all agents dread to hear but are trained to respond to, gun. He put himself in front of the president and then managed to reach for the gun before she could pull back on the slide that would have put the first several bullets in the gun chamber. He managed to lodge his hand. Actually, it's that thin membrane of skin between the thumb and the forefinger. He got that down between the hammer and the firing pin. And so the only blood that we shed that day was Larry Boondorf's when the hammer actually penetrated his hand. In any event, she said the gun didn't go off. Can you believe it? It didn't go off. She was handcuffed. The president, surrounded by agents who sort of set up this flying wedge, and classic Ford, he didn't want to overdramatize the situation. He told him to slow down. He stood up. He actually adjusted his tie. After all, he was going in to see Governor Brown. He wanted to look his best. Went into the Capitol, never mentioned what happened. And in fact, it was 20 minutes into their conversation before an aide came up and told Governor Brown what had happened. He said, "Are you okay, Mr. President?" He said, "I'm fine." It just wasn't something he was going to waste his time, he said, waste the governor's time talking about something that had happened. 2 weeks later, you can imagine, there was a big argument in the White House between the security people and the political people about whether he should go back to California. And he said, "I'm not going to be held captive." And he thought it was very symbolically important. So he went back, this time to San Francisco, spoke to the AFL-CIO. He came back to the St. Francis Hotel. Now, Union Square, there's a park right in front of the hotel. There were several thousand protesters. And the Secret Service said, "This is not a friendly crowd. Don't come out the front entrance." So they went out a side entrance on Post Street, and there was a small crowd there, and in it was this 50-ish housewife named Sarah Jane Moore, who had become involved in kind of the radical politics of the Bay Area in the 70s, had an obsession with Patty Hearst. In any event, the amazing thing is that over the weekend, she had been visited by the San Francisco police, who knew all about Sarah Jane Moore. They confiscated a gun and 113 rounds of ammo. The day before, the Secret Service interviewed her and did not detain her. The reason being, in my opinion, she was also a government informant. I mean, this is, a story within a story within a story. In any event, she had been forced to buy a new gun, 38 Smith & Wesson, and she didn't realize that the sight was about 6 inches off. That's why when the president came out of the hotel, she was only 40 feet away, almost point-blank range, and she fired a shot but missed by literally about 6 inches.
That was presidential historian Richard Norton Smith.
Whoa, landing an account this big will totally change my landscaping business. It's going to mean hiring more guys and more equipment and new trucks for the new guys to drive the new equipment in. I don't know if I'm ready.
You can do this. And Ford Pro FinSimple can help. Our experts are ready to make growing pains less painful for your business with flexible financing solutions that meet the needs of your business today when you need them. Get started at FordPro.com/financing.
Finally, Brookings Institution's William Gulston talked about how both Vice President Harris and former President Trump are avoiding addressing the issue of the national debt.
Joining us this morning is Bill Gulston. He's the Senior Fellow for Governance Studies at Brookings Institution, here to talk about campaign 2024 and the national debt. Mr. Gulston, you wrote this piece in the Wall Street Journal. A U.S. national debt crisis is coming. Trump and Harris are determined to ignore the problem at the country's peril. What is the crisis that is coming?
Well, for your younger viewers, Greta, a little bit of history may help. By the end of the previous century, we had four straight years of budget surpluses. We were actually paying down the national debt, which stood at about a third of our gross domestic product. Since then, we've been piling up deficits and debt annually. We have added $25 trillion to the national debt over the past two decades. And in the next decade alone, we're on track to add another $22 trillion for a grand total of $50 trillion. And that's not free money, because we have to pay interest on it. And by the end of the next 10 years, the interest payments on the national debt will be almost twice what we're spending on national defense, on domestic programs. And we'll be, in effect, borrowing money to pay interest on the debt. That is not a sustainable situation. It's not a crisis that overwhelms the system all at once. It's sort of like slow motion bleeding that weakens the patient and ultimately leads to death. It's very difficult to make this a front burner issue, but at some point we're going to have to start talking about it.
Sticking with history, what has led us to this point? What major policies over the years that you were talking about has led to this situation?
Well, starting early in the current century, we've had tax cuts that we didn't pay for. We've had spending increases that we didn't pay for. We've had two major economic crises where we had to throw money at the problems. And in addition, we have an aging society. And an aging society is an expensive society, because costs for programs such as Social Security and Medicare tend to rise more rapidly than the gross domestic product of the United States. And we have really ignored all of those problems on the tax side, on the spending side, on the financial emergency side, and the problems created by an aging society. And at some point, we're going to have to reckon with them.
Why? Why at some point? You were alluded to it earlier, but what could happen?
Well, the number one risk, as far as I'm concerned, is that eventually the debt will get so large that lenders, both domestic and foreign, will begin to wonder and worry about our capacity to repay it. And as a result, they will require significantly higher interest rates in order to compensate them for what they see is as the risk of default. And at that point, we will have a financial crisis. We had a big problem when interest rates rose as high as 7%. What will happen if they rise to twice that, which they have been in my lifetime? We have, I think, a serious problem for the future. Everything depends on the willingness of both domestic lenders and foreign lenders to keep on lending us money at affordable interest rates as the deficit piles ever higher.
You said that the two candidates are ignoring the issue. They're not talking about it. They are, though, putting forth policies that would impact deficits. What's the difference between deficits and debt, and what do you make of their policies?
Well, a deficit is what happens every fiscal year. Okay, spend $6 trillion, you take in $4 trillion, you have a deficit of $2 trillion. What's the difference between those two? It's financed by borrowing, and borrowing adds to the debt. A deficit occurs every year. Debt is permanent unless you pay it. Both candidates, I think it's fair to say, have ignored the problem. Donald Trump has proposals that would make the problem even worse. Kamala Harris has also proposed policies that would do nothing to reduce the long-term debt and would add a little bit to it. So it's not a perfect symmetry. And various analyses, including one performed by the Wall Street Journal just yesterday and by the Washington Post today, confirm that the Trump proposals would be even more expensive than the Harris proposals. But what I can say safely is that neither candidate would do anything to stop the bleeding. And the issue of the deficit was barely touched upon in the presidential debate last week. And that is a real sign that neither the candidates nor the journalistic community is particularly interested in talking about this.
That was Brookings Institution's William Gulston. Hear more interviews from C-SPAN's Washington Journal on our website at cspan.org, on the C-SPAN Now app, or on C-SPAN Television, live every morning from 7 to 10 a.m. Eastern.